a lot of the work that I do with the gem style, there's statements inside of there.
Right.
And those statements are very personal. I mean, they might kind of seem like overarching statements, but they have to do with something that is, you know, happened to me personally. And that was kind of how I digested it. And then the vehicle was the artwork.
Welcome to Architecture, Design, and Photography in our long-standing COVID setup. But today we are lucky enough to be talking with Ryan Adams. Ryan Adams is a painter and muralist residing in his hometown of Portland, Maine, with his wife Rachel Gloria.
Mm-hmm.
Two names, nice. Yeah. Is she from the South?
No, she's from Massachusetts. Oh, okay. So South, I guess, from here.
Yeah, she's from the South. Rachel Gloria and their two daughters. His background in traditional graffiti led him to creating large-scale mural work and hand-lettered design and signage. His signature gem style of work is a geometric breakdown of letter forms of shadows and highlights included to create depth and movement throughout the pieces, which, by the way, I have to say, are awesome after through them. And I think I've seen them around town here and there. Thanks. His pieces tend to be bold, colorful, and clever. I'll second that. I love your stuff that looks like it's potentially like tattoos and stuff that people could get. I love the irony and the cleverness in those.
Thank you.
Often including statements within. Currently, Ryan co-owns and operates a hand-painted signage business, designs for a brewery, paints murals and murals any and everywhere, and exhibits his work as often as possible. Ryan, thank you so much for coming down to hang out and talk with me, and sorry for butchering your about page there.
No worries whatsoever. Thanks so much for having me.
So how have you been doing in this illustrious time for the last year that we've been experiencing?
Oh my gosh. Doing okay. I guess as okay as one can be. On the work front, I feel very fortunate. It was very steady this year.
So work stayed steady for you?
It did. It did. It was actually, so the timing of everything was pretty wild. I had been working a full-time corporate day job as well as having my art practice for the last decade. Up until the end of February.
Wow.
So I finally quit, and then 2 weeks later, everything shut down.
Right. Wow.
So it was terrifying, utterly terrifying at first, but ended up working out okay. Ended up working out all right. So,
okay, what were you doing in the corporate world?
I was doing business development and business management for a broker based out of Rhode Island, and I was managing the Hannaford account for them. So I had about 50 or so different manufacturers that I was managing for Hannaford.
So what does that actually mean?
Oh my gosh. It is extremely boring, but basically the manufacturers would get their products into Hannaford, or I would work with them to kind of show them Hannaford's guidelines and what they're looking for. They would present.
As far as like graphically or creatively, or
no, this is like we're talking like sponges and plates and like things
so
like that.
So you weren't working in the corporate world as a creative,
absolutely
essentially,
not.
Like more of a manager.
Yeah,
that's an interesting. And you had the ability to do that. You were doing it for 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Yet
yeah.
You're this insanely creative out there doing. Really, I mean, Danielle ran your work by me to be like, how about we interview this guy and do him for Design Theory? And I was like, oh my word.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
That's really cool that you have that part of your brain and the other part of the brain in the same brain.
Yeah, it was strange. It was kind of like the double life sort of thing, because people in my day job had no idea about my art practice on the whole.
Uh-huh.
And a lot of people that knew me from my art practice had no idea that I had this other extremely boring
totally
day job.
yeah.
So it was a lot for a few years there, but finally was able to transition out.
Yeah. And how long did you take to plan for that? And did you know that's exactly what you wanted to do? And
yeah, so it was, I'm trying to think. So I always knew that I wanted to have kind of a creative life and have that be at the forefront. But, you know, Sally Mae was involved, and I had to, you know, had to handle Sally Mae. So I had to get a nice solid day gig to kind of get to a certain point. And I think it was around the time of the birth of my first daughter was when my wife and I kind of looked at each other like, okay, we gotta hit the gas and actually make this transition over. So
like, how was your wife involved in that transmission? That's interesting to me. Like, how the other half of this, does your wife work as well?
Yes. Yep.
And now does she have a completely separate career outside of what you're doing through art, or is she involved in that?
She's basically where I was a few years ago, where she has the full-time day job and then her practice outside of that. So
what's her practice outside
of? So, yep, she's a textile designer. So she actually just started Tachi, which is her company, and it's textile design and kids clothes. Actually, she just started that up. And she's also the project manager for Better Letter, which is our hand-painted signage and mural company that we own with Will Sears and Tess O'Brien. So so it's a busy lifestyle. But
yeah, kids clothes are interesting to me because as I started having kids, I noticed they still use like adult level fabrics on them that when you transfer them to a kid wearing them, it's like they're in really, really heavy canvas rather than, you know,
it was.
And I wondered, are people thinking about this more? Or?
Yeah, it was interesting to see her kind of dive into that and kind of look into like sourcing different materials for clothing and things like that. I mean, there was so much more involved. I mean, to me, I was like, oh, yeah, screen print, you know, then with of course, there was way more. And it was interesting to see how much was involved in that. But yeah, it's pretty cool to watch.
So talk to me about how scary that transition was and how did you prepare for it? Just so people listening to this that see, oh, wow, someone's making a living as an artist, which is an infinitesimally difficult or hard mark to hit. It's very difficult, but you're doing it successfully and you planned for it. So like walk me through that process.
So, I think, like I said, it was around the time of my first daughter's birth. We kind of looked at each other and we're like, okay, now is the time to hit the gas and make this a reality. So basically, I mean, there was no shortcut. It was just kind of like, okay, you do your day job and then you dedicate every hour outside of that you can to your practice and to getting as much stuff out there as you possibly could. And it was about three years of just working, you know, seven days a week, maybe having a day off a month sort of schedule, and just trying to build up as much momentum as I could with the creative practice and kind of spreading it out, because I had the signage kind of business going, and then also I had the murals going. And I was fortunate enough to pick up a design job for a brewery as well. So kind of once I had things kind of spread out and there was different, revenue streams, different ways to kind of make money creatively, I started to kind of put more and more into those and start to make the transition away from the day job. It was terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying. I have two little ones, and ever since college, I mean, all I've known really is having that base, having that corporate day job. So,
What was college for you? Was it a creative field or was it management field?
No, it was actually clinical psych. So I bounced all over the place.
Psych, that's fun.
Yeah. I mean, it was basically, I had no clue what I really wanted to do when I was 18 years old. I was like, this looks interesting. So that's the route that I took. The journey has been interesting because it's kind of bopped around. You know, I didn't see myself ending up in this business management role. Now I'm kind of living what was a dream for a very long time. So yeah, but lots of hours put in to get here. Yeah, like I said, terrifying when made the jump, you know?
So you grew up in Portland?
Yep.
From Portland.
Portland, Maine. Mm-hmm.
And you chose to stay here.
Yeah. which is rare. I think a lot of folks that I grew up with were like, see you later.
How many of the folks that said see you later came back though?
That's a really good question. Out of my like core group of friends, all four that have left have not come back actually. So they committed to it. Actually, two of them are in other countries, so they really took off. But yeah. So I ended up breaking my leg very badly when I was living down in Boston, and I had to come back home for a couple. I had two surgeries actually, and when I was back home, I was like, "Wow, this place is changing." And I was like, "It's a little bit different than when I left." So stuck around. Yeah. Glad I did.
Yeah, I didn't grow up here, but as soon as I interacted with the region, I was just like, wow, there's something here
for sure.
This is nice. Sure. And yeah. Having, you know, been to a lot of different places that I would consider living in the US, even after choosing to be here, I'm constantly like, yeah, no, I'd rather be in Maine. Absolutely.
We're really spoiled here, you know. I think it's just we have access to so many wonderful things, and you can have kind of big town, small city,
right?
Or you can be in the middle of nowhere, and like it's all
a lot of the time attainable. When I'm shooting in Boston, people are kind of like, why do you live in Maine? And there's a degree of like, well, if I have to explain it to you, you're not going to get it. You know, to go home to just hear peepers in the woods at night when you are in like the busy life of Boston during the day is a really neat thing.
Absolutely.
And to not feel like you're just a mile off of Route 1 down in Saugus or wherever, but you're actually, you know, pretty far out there and still close to the ocean. It's really nice.
Definitely.
Yay, Maine.
Yeah, that's right. Go Maine.
So a clinical psychology background.
Yes.
Went into management and now living the dream
that
you wanted to do as an artist.
Yep.
And where did you get this creative drive and how did you develop it and know that that specifically is what you wanted to do?
It's been a strange journey. So I've always kind of drawn, been into art and creating. Ever since I was a little kid, I've always drawn things like, you know, just kind of copied what was in my comic books and the cartoons I'd see on TV. But this whole drive and kind of this obsession with creating started with graffiti, writing graffiti. I was given a copy of Subway Art, which is a book by Martha Cooper and Henry Chalfant that chronicles the 70s and 80s New York City subway graffiti movement. I was given a copy of that when I was about 10 years old, and it just blew my mind completely. I was like, what is this? You know, I'm living in Maine, so I'm not really seeing too much of it.
Except on the trains when they come through.
Actually, back then, even though like on the freights, there wasn't too much activity. There wasn't too much. I mean, you maybe see one every few cars, but there wasn't a lot then. Mm-hmm. So it was very just like, what is this? And, you know, it's kind of pre-internet days. So I was like, how do I find out more about this? So I just kind of started collecting magazines where I could find it and things like that. And as I got a little bit older, I was able to kind of venture outside of the house and find places where graffiti was happening. And it just turned into an obsession. I mean, there was so much unknown, you know, like, how did they figure this out? Did they do this with all spray cans? When did they do this? Like, who did this? There was so much that I didn't know. I was just absolutely captivated. So, a few years later, when I'm in my teen years, I started to try to figure it out and made a mess. But, you know, you just went right after it. And from there, it was like I was just obsessed with getting better, getting the hang of it. And through that came kind of an obsession with letter forms and figuring out like how can I, well, first basic letter forms, which are way more difficult to master or figure out than one might think. And from there, kind of how can I manipulate these so that they're still recognizable
abstract them, but still be recognizable.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah, I love to look at your. I love to look at your stuff, and you just kind of see it arise out of there. But it's complex, and it's you know it's there, and you can read it, but it's still difficult. But it's beautiful.
Thank you.
It's kind of a, you know, it's a play on the deeper meanings of life. I think you kind of have you see it and you feel it, but to articulate it, you really have to take some time.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Yeah, yeah, that's very well put. That's better than I'm normally like, yeah, I just want people to stare at it for longer. But yeah, that's kind of where the whole drive started. I, like I said, I just kind of became obsessed with it, and so much was learned from that. Color theory, figuring out colors, figuring out balance, and just how to paint big, and but how to, you know, kind of still focus on the details. And I learned so much from that experience of painting graffiti, and it all just kind of blossomed from there and led me down a few different paths. So I
love the documentary Exit Through the Gift Shop, even from my very, I'm very uneducated really in art and don't have much of a discernment when it comes to art other than just what I connect with.
Sure.
You know? I love the, you know, the irony and everything else in Banksy's stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's an artist that I did some work with, Heather Chantos, that it's just like emotion on canvas. Mm-hmm. It's, to me, amazing stuff. But I've always appreciated, you know, graffiti is like, at some level, it's destruction of property. But at the same time, it's like, no one's paying these people to do this, and they're expressing themselves in the areas where people aren't looking or watching, but there's this drive to go out and express and create, even if no one wants it, you know, but it still has to come out somewhere. It's like, it's within humanity, and it's kind of like the pressure's building and it has to come out somewhere. You know?
100%.
It's such a, to me, such an interesting thing. I love driving or, you know, riding the train into Boston. And as you get closer, you see more and more of it.
Yep.
And to me, that's always just a neat thing to see. And to watch Exit to the Gift Shop and to see the, you know, his reflection of like, I'll be a lot more careful next time I tell people to go out and create, you know, like how the French dude that just got consumed with like, making stuff, and he couldn't put down a camera, and but then he just got like sucked up into the weird world of higher end art and everything too, you know.
Yeah,
but the guy put everything on the line to do it.
Absolutely,
it was such a weird trip. And have you seen who the bleep is Jackson Pollock? Just for the kids listening.
I have not, actually. I'm sorry.
It is so. I am so, so deeply fascinated by this one character that they bring in that assesses the art. He's a really high-end fine art guy who's seriously into his own opinion.
Yeah.
And is from the really high
out there.
But it's like, whoa, this guy is onto something, but it feels like he himself is doing performance art in just trying to objectively say if this thing is a Jackson Pollock or not.
Mm-hmm.
And he just does these weird motions and like, and it's just like, wow, this guy's taking himself way too seriously. Yeah. But at the same time, people are putting down 10 to 50 million for these things.
Absolutely.
And like something's happening in the higher echelons of society as far as wealth and everything that they do figure out like there's something in this art, you know. I'd love to see a documentary that dives deep into the absurd but real part of the high art of our society.
I think coming from the world where I was creating solely because I had to, and I was pouring my heart and soul into something that 99% of the population hates.
Think 99.
Not 99. Yeah, I mean, it felt
that
way.
I'd say a strong 70.
Strong 70, yeah.
Of the remaining 30, 50% of them won't admit it.
Yeah,
and then the
there
last,
you go.
You know, yeah,
it's pretty cool. Yeah, definitely. So the majority of folks really can't stand it. And it was... something I was really putting my all into. That, I think, kind of gave me, I don't want to say, a different outlook on my creations and a different, I guess, standpoint from when I'm in kind of the fine art world now. It's, or just even my introduction into that world and breaking out of the graffiti world. It's so much just my expression in something that I have to do.
Right.
That it's okay if folks don't dig it. You know, and that's kind of, I never, the root in my creating was never to kind of, I guess, impress a certain crowd or to, I guess, gain the attention of a certain crowd. It was always just from me. This is how I know how to express myself in something that's so ingrained in me as a person that I have to do it.
Right.
And yeah, I think that's,
Now what would happen to you if you didn't respond to that call?
I get
pulling
cranky
on your psychological psych background.
Yeah. Oh wow. That's a good question. A lot of repression, a lot of repressed emotions, I think, because the moments where I'm creating and I'm by myself and I'm just kind of in this zone, it's very meditative, and I'm able to. A lot of the work too, I mean, when you're painting, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it's cyclic, you know, it's like, okay, dab, brush, or cut, shape, spray, or, you know, step aside, measure, spray. So it's easy to get kind of into a rhythm to where you're kind of on autopilot to a certain extent, and your mind is able to kind of think about other things and process other things. So that's kind of my moments of meditation and reflection and working things out that are going on even outside of the art practice that I have. So if I did not have that wouldn't, you know, I think I'd kind of be struggling a little more with some other things.
Is there aspects of life that drive that creativity for you that you can talk about?
Yep. So that's actually a good question, because I've recognized that in times of turmoil when my life was going through big changes, breakups, massive, you know, moves, things like that, I really put out a lot of work that I still kind of enjoy.
Right.
So I had to figure out, because I don't want to keep my life in that space. There was a point where I had to kind of figure out, okay, like, how do I keep that sort of momentum going when things are a little more stable?
Right. Like, great albums come from like breakups.
Yeah.
For artists, you know?
Like, and I actually like the gem style that I still use, and even kind of the watercolors that I do, kind of the image based, all sparked from times where things were not so great outside of, you know, the, and I was just, you know, either in the studio or just, you know, painting somewhere and was just so locked in. And so that's very real, that in times of turmoil, like, I think kind of more creative sparks happen.
I have a theory on all that. But the best way for me to test it is to see if you'll repeat it without me saying it.
Okay.
Especially given your background
with
psychology and everything else. But before I'm so good at losing my train of thought.
I hear you. Yeah, right there with you.
So when someone goes through something difficult, that affects them emotionally. I mean, first of all, your emotions start to become very loud in your own head that are unresolved, some, you know, breakup, whatever, right? And they're kind of screaming at you. And so I've come to, man, there's so much. But I've come to, the creativity comes from an emotional place, in my opinion.
Okay.
Yep. And I've kind of come to this, I'm just going to go to the, straight to the conclusion,
sure.
I guess. But it seems to me nothing, and by nothing, I mean everything nothing.
Sure.
Like yeah. Nothing comes into existence without creation.
True.
Yep.
Like, and I'm talking metaphysically.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So to try and interact with someone who's highly creative and has a psych background, the most creative types mm-hmm. of people that we would label like, oh, he's so creative, are often people that have this psychological trait of openness,
mm-hmm.
open to experience,
yep.
right? Not mm-hmm. not necessarily conscientious people.
Yes.
Conscientious people will more so regard art as something to be maybe a little suspicious of. You know, but without the people open to experience,
mm-hmm.
going out and experiencing,
mm-hmm.
and then processing that, what they do is they take their experience, breakup or whatever, mm-hmm. and they process it by trying to make sense of it in some way, and turning that into something of more concrete value
mm-hmm.
that rings of truth mm-hmm. to them
mm-hmm.
that they can then share with the world as a means of using the rest of society or their friendships or relationships as a net to keep them from falling too far.
Mm.
Do you see what I'm saying there?
I do.
In one way, it keeps them from falling too far by the expression of that, and then in the embodiment of that experience into art,
mm-hmm.
it becomes a verification of what you experience by other people viewing it and saying, this rings true.
Understood, yep.
And then that artist has created something that has further clarified truth.
Yes.
And I so yep. if a piece of art does not ring true,
mm-hmm.
or a piece of art can ring very true for maybe a very, very narrow slice of consciousness, like maybe it's for just sure. for you
yep.
and it means a lot for you and it's just not going to touch other people, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have value to others. Mm-hmm. It's just extremely specific. But the process of creativity is the process of openness, experience, and then objectification.
Yeah, that's interesting to think of it.
Yeah,
way,
I mean, we don't like to say the word because we immediately think of like get barefoot and pregnant in the kitchen.
Yes, yep, yep.
And
yep.
you're just for sex and making food. We're yep. going to objectify you. That's what we think of objectification.
But it makes sense here.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's not a. It's just a word that's been too strongly
yes.
tied
yep.
to a situation, mm-hmm. right? And I do not profess objectifying.
Yeah.
Bad idea. But anyways, don't do that.
Yeah.
It won't go well.
Yeah.
But your experience
mm-hmm.
interacted with in a creative manner, you can objectify that into
yes.
something of more concrete
mm-hmm.
utility,
mm-hmm.
right? And if you think about it, absolutely everything that is a creation
mm-hmm.
at some level. And I'm not going to straight literal six-day creation, God said.
Sure.
But if you think of... if you were to draw a model of our reality, I would draw it as a square with a circle that goes through it with a dot in the middle.
Okay.
And the person who is open, the
mm-hmm.
in the major categories of our lives are openness and conscientiousness
mm-hmm.
In the big five psychological personality traits. And the individuals, we all benefit from the articulated knowledge that holds our society
absolutely.
Together,
mm-hmm.
right? The liberal benefit, the more open person benefits from that consistency and safety.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
all want a home, mm-hmm. you know?
Yep.
And the conscientious or conservative people maintain that,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
They might not be the ones going out and as open to experience and objectifying further truth to add to that articulated knowledge.
Yep.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But they are the ones who primarily judge if whatever you've gone out into the chaos and come back in with
sure.
is of any value.
That is true.
Mm-hmm. To add mm-hmm. to our articulated knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that process of creativity
mm-hmm.
and then judging that creativity as being something of worth to add to our, you know, lexicon of what we consider. And the, like, an idea of something like that that comes to mind to me is that art is essentially the seed of law. And by that, I mean Harriet Beecher Stowe, Uncle Tom's Cabin, change.
True. Laws
that protect.
Yep.
So she took a situation and turned it into a work of art that just hit people's hearts and was like, whoa.
Yeah.
This is wrong. And that work of art made laws, you know? And if you think of that, I mean, there's different levels of clarity on subjects, but every work of art is an objectification of someone's experience, you know?
That's true.
And for me to look at any bit of our reality is it like at a more metaphysical level, I tend to see like the closest ideology I could get to thinking of a God would be the idea of love. And if you were to objectify love, like if you were to experience love and turn that into something that would be of more concrete utility, it would be law. So there's, and I know that sounds like contrary to like, but I thought you were talking creatively. But the so there's this process of nominalization and denominalization.
Okay.
I'm just going to lose everyone that's listening
to this.
I'm
into it. They'll be all right.
So there's this, when we have elections, a group of people say we, as a collective, would like to have one person represent us to the Senate or Congress or whatever, state level, whatever. And you nominate a person, right? So this single thing represents all of this abstract chaos.
For sure.
Essentially, right? You nominate them, they're your nominee, and they represent you. Now, you've kind of hourglassed into this representative.
Sure.
Now they go somewhere and they denominalize. They take, all right, the will of the people embodied in me. Now I take the will of the people and speak it into the building of law, essentially.
Yep.
So, and it's also interesting, like if you're a religious person, you're part of a denomination. Which a denomination is essentially the other side of the hourglass.
Yep.
Like they took spiritual experience and they nominalized it into a religion.
Into the religion.
And then on the other side, the people denominalize it out into the world. That is a creative process.
Yeah. I see what you're saying there.
You see that?
Yeah, I do.
Abstract experience, spiritual experience, whatever they think they're interacting with. And they try and codify, or they nominalization means to turn something from a verb to a noun. So from an action, an experience into an object or something resembling an object like religion. And then from religion, they denominalize it, turn it back into a verb, your actions in the world.
Yeah.
That is a creative process. And that process of just building our society, right? That if you go back to the square and the circle that intersects it, it's the same thing. The more liberal people are saying, we got to get out and experience and create. We got to go take this chaos and turn it into something useful. That's kind of the drive of like what I was getting at, asking you like, why do you feel this need to create?
Sure.
You've got a mind and a personality that you're born with that just tells you there's further truth out there. And there's no, like, creativity is the process of truth to me. And every work of art is some further clarification at the most, I don't want to say infantile, but at the most, it's the first coming together of a I almost want to say translation of experience. Yeah, it's a translation of experience into object.
Yeah. Yeah.
Work of art, you know?
Absolutely. I mean, I think kind of, I think about that in a similar way, where I see my work and even art in general as a vehicle to kind of discuss, or a way to kind of talk about things that are normally fairly difficult to talk about. Mm. I often liken it to like stand-up comedians, how if you're able to make something funny, you can really talk about anything. Mm-hmm. And I think kind of visual art can fall into that same category.
Right.
If you can make something that is appealing or make something that is, I guess, like attractive visually, you can express things that would normally be very difficult to just look someone in the eye and talk about.
Right.
A lot of the work that I do with the Gem Style, there's statements inside of there.
Right.
And those statements are very personal. I mean, they might kind of seem like overarching statements, but they have to do with something that is, you know, happened to me personally. And that was kind of how I digested it. And then the vehicle was the artwork to get it out there.
It's, so it's you nominalized it.
Absolutely.
And someone else is going to come and look at your work of art, and it's going to do something in their mind if they spend some time with it, mm-hmm. that they will then denominalize it out into the world.
Yep.
Like they'll maybe have one interaction where that message that was in your art sat in their mind, and then in that interaction they thought, you know what, instead I'm going to do this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yep, absolutely. And I think I see it even more with public art, with things like that, when I'm able to do a mural that says something like just keep swimming or something like that, which, you know, we all know Finding Nemo, but also was something that through a tough time in my life, I had to kind of repeat in my head in order to get through it.
Yeah.
And you see people kind of spend time with the work, and like you kind of mentioned, it takes a minute for the words to pop out, and then they kind of sit with it, and you see it kind of, I don't know, just kind of, they take it in, and you can watch it happen on a public level like that. I mean, it is the vehicle for me to get these things out there.
Right.
So yeah.
Now
yeah.
I really appreciate the work of humor in some of your stuff.
Thanks.
Irony and humor. what is your, do you have an idea or a clarification on humor? Like if you were to describe humor to someone who didn't know what humor was, like,
oh, wow, that's a good question. If I were to explain humor, I think it would be an observation of some sort of human behavior or something that is happening around you, and figuring out the most absurd parts of that behavior or that experience. And kind of highlighting them.
Right.
Because I think with any experience or with any behavior, there's absurd parts to all of it.
Mm-hmm.
Highlighting that kind of helps. That's, once again, kind of helps to, I guess, convey the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
To be like, listen, everything that we do has an absurd aspect to it. Let's talk about this part of it because, you know, come on, it's pretty light.
Right.
But here's the rest of it.
Right.
You know, like, and that's kind of how those pieces that I do kind of, I hope, work.
Yeah. I screen grabbed the one of Life is Short. I forget what the tagline was, but it's basically a picture of a cubicle. It was like life is short,
give up on your dreams.
Give up on your dreams.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, there's like, oh. Hmm. But I was trying to figure out humor the other day and trying to find a definition that worked for me to understand it more, because I love listening to stand-up comedians, but there's certain ones that are like at a level that's like almost slapstick, or it's not really philosophical.
Yeah.
And then you get into like the Dave Chappelle, and it's like, whoa, there's philosophy going on here.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I found is that humor is a cousin to being startled. If you were to pop out and scare someone, all of a sudden running into such a striking contrast causes them to usually make an involuntary noise. And you
true.
Know,
yep.
And humor, when it hits you, is a very similar thing, that it's like,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And it's, it, it seems to me that humor is finding areas of high contrast within our own interactive reality.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so when you find that high contrast, that juxtaposition, I think would be the right word.
Sure.
That it, it makes you, if you can find it and illuminate it to where everyone sees that high contrast, humor does that, you know?
Yeah, I think that's kind of essentially what I was trying to say by finding those absurd moments, because it's absurd moments and things that are serious.
Yeah.
You know, things that are, so that's that contrast that we were talking about. So it's like, it could be a very serious, what most people
or contradiction.
Would con- yes, yeah. yes, there you go. Yep, and finding that contradiction or that that absurd moment within something that's very serious, I think, kind of helps to digest it, you know? Yeah. And yeah, there's those pieces, those kind of illustrative pieces that I do are extremely personal. They're, that all started from keeping a visual diary of something that was happening. And
oh,
it was
nice.
Just like, yeah, yeah. So I just started kind of just like drawing things out. And I'm a jokester. I mean, I've always kind of just been that guy that, you know, kind of laugh through it, which can be good in some areas and not so much in others. But that's kind of how it came out.
Right.
I would be drawing these like ironic things about, you know, pretty deep-seated issues that were going on. So
yeah,
that helps. That helps a lot. I actually started a series during the beginning of COVID. I called them like the COVID Diaries, and they were just black and white drawings of just kind of illustrating what was happening during this time. I mean, it was such a unique time period that I was like,
yeah,
there's so much happening up here. I have to, you know, figure this out. And
sure.
started a series for that too. So
oh, cool.
Yeah,
I'd love to see that someday. That'd be some interesting observations.
Yeah, I can show you. They're interesting. I mean, you know, trapped in the house with the kids, not right. knowing what's going on. You know, there's a lot of material. A lot of material to work.
Yeah.
From.
So, in a similar manner to your visual diary, I probably 10 years ago, you know, really was honest with myself about losing the faith that I grew up in. And it's a really painful but awakening time to go through something like that,
for
because
sure.
you thought you had a very clear picture on the world if you're part of certain types of religions, as it gives you a you know, just a perfect reflection of everything that's going on supposedly.
Yeah.
And to lose that, it's like an immediate death sentence, because all of a sudden you hear the timer going.
Yeah, wow.
Like, oh, there's an impending maw of destruction coming for me, where before I thought it was a, you know, a little kind of skip across a lake into, you know, fluffy fields of something and happiness where everyone that you love is waiting for it, you know. It's like it's Friday at 5 p.m. in the factory, and you're running for the door when the bell goes, and everyone else is like, "Whoa, sorry, you didn't hear that we have to work all week."
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's a big letdown. But once
imagine.
You saw off the limb that you sit on, the real dark part of it is that you realize that no limb is safe.
Yeah,
like, but there's a Buddhist saying of the bad news, no. The bad news is that you're free falling through thin air. The good news is there's no ground, you know? So it's like this weird thing, but it also makes you very, very open to looking at and sawing off the limbs that other people sit on once you've sawn off your own.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you approach things far more even-handedly if you can emotionally process it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I've kept a room of sticky notes that are all graphic visualizations of concepts that I've been working on, trying to get to the bottom of the idea of what, because everyone contemplates the idea of God. It's unavoidable that you're, you know, be religious, spiritual, yay or nay, whatever. All of this is here going on. And we really have, in many ways, no clue.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
absolutely no idea.
Okay,
yeah.
Even if it's the Big Bang, like, well, how did that happen?
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And that's where I got down to this idea of creativity, where if you keep... It's like the creations that we've come up with are the most clarified but most shallow data points that we have. And if you were to come up with a concept or a definition for God, it would be the deepest truth of most abstraction.
Mm. Okay.
Do you see what I'm saying there?
Kind of.
Every truth that you can bring into existence through a creative process comes from experience.
For sure.
From relationship.
Yep.
Not necessarily between husband and wife or kid and friends, or but just relating to the world.
The world, exactly, yeah.
Nothing comes into being unless it is created, and creation only happens through relating to something than in objectifying it.
Sure.
And so if you start to walk those processes backwards,
okay,
the further you go backwards, you're abstracting everything.
Mm.
Because everything that we interact with is an objectification. So you're subjectifying everything backwards. You're denominalizing it, but in the other direction, right?
Wow. Okay.
So you're taking a religion and turning it back into spiritual experience rather than actions in the world.
Okay. Yep.
Denominalization would be actions in the world back into that ambiguous spiritual experience, right?
Okay. Yep.
So if you go the other direction, where we came from, it just gets more and more abstract the further you go back.
For sure.
Yet the really...
Okay.
The religions that grow fast are the ones that tell you we have an extremely clear idea of the most abstract.
Yep.
Which to me is... I don't know if disingenuous is the right word, but it's not... It doesn't feel like that could be true if I'm honest about my experience, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we grasp on to what's tangible. I mean, you know, it's the idea of it being that abstract and that unknown is terrifying when you really think about it. So, yeah, when they hand you something that's on a plate that you can touch and feel,
to the bank?
Okay. Yeah. It's going to resonate for the majority of us, I would say.
Let's see, that's the... It's interesting, like, and my son memorizes Bible verses because my wife's still very religious.
Sure, yeah.
And she was gone and we were doing homeschool, and so she's like, go through his Bible verses with him. Mm-hmm. He's like, I'll put my emotional issues aside and I will do this.
Gotta do
it. Yep. And there's one that was something about a call to love being not in word or something else. Not in word or tongue, but in deed and truth.
Mm.
And truth to me only comes by creativity. Mm-hmm. And deed only comes from a objectification of experience into some kind of thing that is true, that you can rely on eventually, that you can put into action. So if I'm thinking about how to understand what God is, I have to first of all think of God as the of deepest truth, but of the most abstraction as well. And that allows you to hold it with an open hand rather than like a clenched fist.
Okay.
You know? And creativity and art is that call to explore that.
Mm.
And so often I think people imagine like, well, interacting with God means that you're going to a church and you're doing these kind of things. Mm-hmm. But any interaction whatsoever with anyone is an experience worthy of searching for truth in that moment.
For sure.
That's what artists do.
I would 100% agree on that front.
Thank you for clarifying reality for us.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty easy. But I do agree that, I mean, especially with most artists, we are just trying to, and I don't want to say clarify, I don't want to say you're looking for a sense of validation, but it's validation in that these experiences are shared. Does that make sense? When I am putting these things out there and I see people that relate and interact with the work, it kind of feels good to know that.
Oh, of course.
You know, you're not alone out here.
Well, I mean, it's such an absurd thing for us to think that we're not so incredibly and deeply connected throughout everything.
Yeah.
but our highly individualistic culture and society tells us, like, it's all about you. Just make sure you're happy. But I do subscribe more so to the idea of take on the responsibility that you can bear, and happiness will come through that. And I think the, you know, the deepest call is to create at all costs.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I'm right there with you. That's the full-time gig now.
It's awesome.
It's creating at all times. And there is a lot of searching that goes into that process, whether it be any lane of the creation. I mean, if it's my own personal fine art, if it's a commercial job, it's like I need to put some truth into it, or at least my truth into the work.
Well, that's the thing that I kept coming back to in conversations with people like this, is that there's something about creativity that you're not solving a math problem. You're pulling from every single experience you've had in your life to relate to the problem that they've handed you as a commercial artist or, you know, or as an architect, or to say, here's a problem. Can you create a good solution to this?
Yeah.
You know, here's a wall that's boring, but we have a, you know, a vision statement for ourselves. Can you embody that in a visual thing?
Yeah.
You know, there's a marked difference between creativity for commercial purposes to serve a need and artistic creation.
For sure.
Do those differ to you?
Well, it's interesting because one kind of feeds the other, I feel. For my own personal artistic exploration, I guess with my own personal fine art, it's what I'm trying to put out there is very personal. So the statements and the techniques are, I'm able to kind of deviate and do whatever comes to me in that moment. What I pull from that might help influence a commercial project.
Yeah, so it's kind of like in exploring your own inner emotions, you can kind of pull out technical processes.
That's 100% what it is.
This will work well in another situation.
Yep, that's exactly what it is. So that exploration that happens in the studio is, you know, just personally driven, completely personally driven. And through that exploration, like you said, there's technical aspects that I'm like, oh my gosh, this might work on a large scale for a mural. And then trying to translate it over. So it kind of, the studio practice feeds the commercial work. And the commercial work affords me the ability to have a studio practice. So I'm hoping to kind of keep it on that cycle. But yeah, absolutely. That's how that works out. So.
Yeah. I've often felt like it's at some level, it's prostitution working as a commercial artist.
It can feel that way for sure.
Yeah. I don't carry that negative connotation.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
But it's like, all right, I am selling, I'm essentially putting a price tag on every experience I've ever had as a means of helping you earn, you
for
know,
sure. No, that's that,
earning
definitely.
More paper with stuff on it or ones and zeros.
Yes.
It doesn't equate. It's not real, but it makes all of this a lot more peaceful when we can make a living, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So it's like,
yeah, it's a piece of every mural or piece or design that I do is it's a piece of me, and it's coming from that creative well that who knows when that well dries up, who knows when, and I can't replicate these things.
I don't think it dries. It only dries up when you die inside.
That's true. Or if you stop experiencing light, which would be that, but see, I guess.
About a year ago, I was pretty dead inside. And like I had spent a long time not being the, out of my own ignorance, I was not the best husband as far as being selfless.
Sure.
and helpful and non-critical. I'm way too critical naturally.
Sure.
And open to negative emotion, neuroticism, openness, melancholy, introvert, you name it.
Sure.
I can have my yeah. my not fun to be around side, you know. Yeah. And about a year ago, my wife and two kids were leaving to go to church, and I, for like the last 6 years, I was like, groupthink is not where I'm comfortable, guys.
Sure,
you know.
Sure.
So I was just kind of sitting next to the door as they were getting ready to leave, and all three of them are like, "Are you okay?" Mm. And I was just kind of like, "Yeah, I'm like this every day. What's wrong?" You know.
Mm-hmm.
But I caught something in them that was like, you know, and what I had done is I had spent like 3 to 5 years probably knowing that my emotions were listening to my emotions to that point without a critical, articulated thinking mind that was well informed on what good behavior actually was, as mm-hmm. far as mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. over criticizing and mm-hmm. judgmental and controlling. I hadn't developed that part of my brain, and I shut off the emotional side and said,
sure,
everything that you thought you wanted me to do,
mm-hmm.
go surfing whenever you want, you know, try and get other people to clean up after me, all of that stuff. I was like, all right, emotions are done here.
Mm.
I'm going to do what I know, like, all right, I'm going to figure this out,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to protect everyone that I'm in charge of by becoming extremely analytical and knowing what to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it had a way of making life a lot easier for my wife.
Sure.
But I internally was in just deep emotional conflict because
yeah.
there was things I didn't understand.
Yep. Yep.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until like a year ago that happened, and all three of them were like, "Whoa, buddy," that I really started to admit to myself that there was some interaction with emotions. I didn't understand emotions and what they were for and why it was so detrimental to just completely shut them, to not listen
yep.
to them,
yep.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, to me, it came around to me, and this is where I think creativity really thrives, is out of emotion, because
mm-hmm.
it's such a... I came to really asking myself, what are emotions?
Okay.
Like, why do we have them?
Sure.
And through a process of meditation one morning, I kind of realized that you have this different kind of like critical observer part of your brain.
Sure.
And then you have this just stream of consciousness where mm-hmm. thought and emotion kind of intertwine.
Yep. Yep.
And it wasn't until one morning when the window was cracked open and there was a cricket just kind of very consistently doing his thing where I went from the critical observer being plastered against like a round jumbotron,
mm-hmm.
you know, like a Times Square thing.
Yep,
it just
yep.
feels like thoughts
yeah.
constantly running. Yeah. And it was like all of a sudden, in just kind of focusing on that cricket with my eyes closed, it's like I peeled off of that jumbotron and was like,
yeah,
right into the center.
Yep.
Everything was still the same, except I wasn't in the stream.
Mm-hmm.
I was next to it, mm-hmm. watching it all go by.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of like, oh, I receive emotions and thoughts, but I have this observer that kind of like processes
yep.
them.
Yep.
And it would be that observer that says, all right, emotions, let's go for a walk and experience something. And then you and I together are going to process this,
mm-hmm.
and then
mm-hmm.
we're going to make art.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yep.
And it wasn't until I gave validity to the emotions being some kind of, I would call it like my native tongue.
Okay. Yeah. So like, yeah, yeah.
when you're born,
yeah.
you don't have any critical observer. You
yeah.
can't articulate a word,
mm-hmm.
but you know full well that you're curious, like, what the hell is this
yep.
on the end of that?
Or you're uncomfortable
this?
And you...
Yeah,
yeah
or
yeah,
like
yeah.
a diaper. Or,
yeah, yeah.
And so I started to see emotions as a native tongue that are like, all right, here's your first language.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And like articulated word, rationality, and reason are your second language.
For sure. For sure. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But it's the combination you got to translate.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I wasn't
yeah.
translating.
Yep.
So I had a bunch of, you know, like I had a bunch of really mad natives in my head. It was like, you're the first people here, and you're just totally screwing it, you know? And it was at that point where things started to switch for me when I looked at it that way.
Yep. Yeah.
And there's something about emotions, creativity, and the objectification of it that all combine to make art. And through art, we then see the objective experience into a more concrete thing that then becomes like the basis of our society. And I've always had a hard time kind of wondering, like, why do people value art so much? But they do. They really do. And when I find a piece that I connect with, I'm just blown away by it.
It's a special moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you see something that you connect with on that level, it's almost like you're speaking in that native tongue to the person who created it. It's almost like...
it's like it takes you back to that moment that person experienced.
Yeah.
And it's
like
you just all of a sudden are lost in it.
Yeah.
You know?
There's few things that I can think of that kind of allow for that connection. You know, I mean, especially without speaking, you know, when you can actually just view something.
You know, I was thinking about that the other day, that you could read Mein Kampf to a baby in a loving tone. And you'd be communicating love to them.
That's an interesting thought. Right? Yeah.
I mean, humor.
Yep.
You could read them the most horrific things.
Yeah.
But they would be like, this person is telling me they love me.
And they would be smiling and
so native tongue completely covered there.
Yeah.
You know, you're smiling, there's a soothing tone and a hunging tone.
Yeah.
You know, and they're just like, boy, that language does sound a little weird.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah.
And this is another weird thing that, like, I asked my son this the other night. I'm kind of repeating myself from another podcast conversation, but who cares?
Yeah.
So was your childhood everything that you dreamed it would be?
Wow, that's a very deep question.
You're a good person to ask this to, though, with your ironic works of art.
Yeah, no, totally. It's totally cool. Was it everything I dreamed it would be? No, I don't think, I think it would be pretty... I would be interested to talk to someone who said yes to that question. I think that in our minds, or at least in mine, I don't want to speak for the general populace here, but in my mind, when I kind of fantasize and think about experiences, there's no trauma involved. It's always like, oh yeah, okay, like everything was great,
right?
But that's not reality. You know, things happen. I grew up in a divorced, you know, family, and things were, you know, so it, when I look at it now,
But I asked you, was it everything you dreamed?
Was it everything I dreamed? And to that, I would say my dreams were not based in reality. They were very, I guess. I mean, that's a very tough question to answer. I think that my everything I dreamed would have no trauma, no issues. It would have been cookie cutter, you know, just a breeze.
Right.
And it was not that. But I am extremely thankful that it was not that, because all of those things that happened to me as a child, or the things that I experienced, made me the person that I am, and gave me a different view to where I can empathize with people that have gone through similar things, or so I guess that would be the answer.
But I asked if it was everything you dreamed it would be, which means you had a chance to dream about your childhood before you had it.
Yeah, which that's, I mean, I'm thinking, so like when I was a kid, thinking about what, like, I don't know, middle school or high school would be like, you know what I mean? So it's like before that.
So that's the first time you interacted with a conscious observer.
Yeah.
So
that's
before
though,
childhood has this, and I base this off of a reflection in my own cabinet. So stupid. So deep, though. So childhood is a time where hopefully responsible adults are around that love you and
sure.
and everything else, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, terrible stuff happens. Mm-hmm. But there's time in childhood where everything is only experienced.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is not compared against anything. So
very true.
I think Theodore Roosevelt has a quote that says, "Comparison is a thief of joy."
Mm.
And we know what it feels like to try and live our lives against someone else's expectations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You don't want to do that,
mm.
right? So when was the first time in life that you started to live against a preconceived expectation mm. for what your life should
mm.
be?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll bet you that when that starts to happen is roughly when you have kind of what I would call a second birth of a critical observer at some
yeah.
point,
yep.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you start to live life with like, well, I didn't expect that this was going to be that way,
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
this is better than I thought it would. There's some degree of overprocessing rather than just experiencing.
Just experiencing, for sure.
And there's something about that just being in that emotional moment
mm-hmm.
that is far more open and magical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's why childhood is such a incredibly impressive, like you have that imprinting happens at that time
mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
and you're so impressionable
yeah.
because you don't have a developed critical observer in your mind yet telling
mm-hmm.
you this is good or bad. I mean, it's why I would imagine that's why we have like don't mess around with kids that are under 18 sexually.
Mm.
There's a logic to that, that they have not matured.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
don't really know critically
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
what life really is. Sorry, 18-year-olds.
Yep.
But
true.
You're not to a point where mm-hmm. you can say from a wealth of experience that this is should and shouldn't yet.
Yes.
And there's yep. an innocence that's protected.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that just experiencing life, that time of life when you're most open to things like that. And like we designed our house and there's this one part of it that's very cool. Like it's floor to ceiling windows and there's rocks outside. And it's really beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And like the first time you come in, you see it and you're like, whoa. And then the second time you're like, whoa. And third time you're like, yeah, that's nice.
Cool.
And,
yeah.
And like 2 years later, you're like, I live here.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Yeah.
But the other day we have these IKEA like glossy cabinets that are white. And
yep.
I went to get something out of the cabinet and the light was just right to where I saw the reflection of that area in the cabinet, but
mm-hmm.
it was reversed.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, whoa. And I turned around and it didn't look like I just saw it reversed.
Yeah.
Now, why
yeah.
is that?
Different perspective.
It was this yeah. totally different
yeah.
perspective I've never seen before.
Yeah.
It was mirrored.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at it again, feeling. I turned around, no feeling.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. I was like, but I'm right here.
Yeah.
Why can't I?
Yeah.
There's something about that, like living without a critical observer and seeing something for the first time,
mm-hmm.
that part
mm-hmm.
of childhood,
mm-hmm.
that helps me understand what emotions are,
mm-hmm.
what maturity actually means, that it's unavoidable that you develop a critical observer,
mm-hmm.
but you have to live in tension with it.
Yep.
Both
yep.
emotionally and critically.
Yep.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
That's, well, no, I think, again, like, I think that's kind of how art can be that vehicle to provide
exactly.
that other perspective.
Music, art.
It's like, we've all had these it's probably an experience we've all had, the base emotion that's behind the work, but this is providing you with a different perspective and you're seeing that or feeling that emotion again in a different way, just like you saw
right.
the structure in a different way. And
well, that's interesting. You're taking something known, like letters, and you're abstracting them,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
but it's through your experience of abstract experience that you kind of worked through these coming to technical truths here and there, that then you focus that experience into creating something, taking something that already exists, but abstracting it a little bit and creating something new out of it.
That
helps give you that new perspective.
Yeah.
It gives you the living room mirrored in the cabinet to a degree.
The fresh perspective. Yeah.
All right. That's interesting.
Yeah. I've actually never thought about it that way myself, but
it's
that is Epiphany time.
Hey-o.
Yeah. That's awesome.
So in Portland, I'd imagine that graffiti artists are somewhat territorial like surfers.
Oh yeah. Okay. That's a thing everywhere. Yeah. Yep.
So I've been to a few places in Portland and a short boat ride outside of Portland that are amazing for graffiti.
Sure. Yeah.
And I don't know if you have like favorite areas that I won't even ask you. Let's just say there's great locations on islands that are amazing to go walk through and see. Like, have I seen some of your work out there?
I don't know. It's been a long time. Yeah. You know, I'm not sure.
I love going through there with my kids and just looking around, and it's just like one thing, like you go around one corner and it's just this whole nother thing, and then don't look at that one, kids.
It's really cool to go to those places where it's allowed to exist, especially the place that I think you're referencing. I spoke to the steward of that area one day, and they were like, they were like, I love it. They're like, I have pictures from like the early 90s up until now. And I was like, oh my gosh.
There should be like a whole representation of photographs of the changing art in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this person has a good amount, because I was out there and I'm like, no way. And they're like, yeah, definitely. Like, we absolutely love it, you know? And
I
think it's special, those places. It's especially the way that that's set up. It's like you kind of have to find it, either that or you just stumble upon it and you're like, wait a second, what is this? And then that's when the exploration starts. And that's definitely special there.
I take my kids out there a lot, and super cool. They when they see it, you know, it's just all flashlights and stuff.
Yeah, that's so much fun. For sure.
Cool. Well, this has been a really interesting conversation. Again, I keep saying at the end of most of these, I hope other people are like, not like, if my wife listens to this one, she's gonna be like, I told you not to talk so much.
No,
I couldn't help it.
Yeah,
I got all these ideas.
There was a lot. I think we covered some pretty cool things, and like, honestly, epiphanies. You know, like a lot of things are kind of uncovered here in this conversation.
It's been just like in the last 2 weeks. I've realized, for me personally, I need to find someone I can talk to, like, that's like psychologist, philosopher, whatever, to work out like a model of how this idea of the part that the highly conscientious person plays in harmony with the highly open person. Because, I mean, even in the political spectrum, you think liberals kind of think like, come on, guys, everyone should think like us and do what we want to do. And then the conservatives think, come on, guys, everyone should think. And the reality is that one without the other is going to go horrifically wrong.
For sure. Yeah.
But it's like they won't admit that. And it's like the combination and the dance that creates the tension is where our purpose is. You know, they're protecting everything we've made, and at the same time inappropriately saying we can't add anything to this.
Yeah.
And then the other side's saying all we can do is create, and let's just destroy everything we've made so far. And it's like, whoa.
Yeah, that's very similar to the analogy with the brain that you were talking about. You know, it's just like you have these two kind of opposing sides, or just, you know, just all of the emotions and everything that's happening, and then there's this critical thinking center, and like, it's where they meet where you find, at least to me, the most efficient ways to express these feelings, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
That's
why that graphic representation to me works as a theory of everything, because I can see that tension and balance in everything. And to me, it brings me to a place of of knowing God. Like I can say that because I can go to a place where the first nominalization of God would be love.
Okay. Yep. Yeah.
So if you take an idea of God, which is ridiculous because it's the absolute of abstraction to me. But if you say, all right, here's an idea, you call it God, turn God into a verb. That verb would be love.
Love, yep.
And if you turn love into nouns or a noun, it would be laws, because laws essentially become a far more deterministic form of love. So you've got a subjective form of law, which is love, that we experientially understand. But if we say, hey, let's all behave in a manner that makes it good for everyone to be around, you'd say, well, let's make laws.
Let's make a structure for it. Yeah.
So you take love and you objectify it, you get law, you know? And it's interesting that, like, I think there's incredibly deep metaphorical truths in, like, the Bible, and that, you know, Moses brought down love objectified when in law. But then in your New Testament deal, you've got God sending down a subjective experience in a human dwelling among us in the form of Christ. These, I can now kind of let go of my shame of even talking about those things in public, because they came to such a place to me that they just made no sense, but they were just literal certainty-based beliefs that people held on to that were just self-deceptive to me, to where I can allow them now to be very metaphorically true and potentially true, but that doesn't matter because the metaphorically true is there for me. I'm going to have to turn this into a religious podcast. No, it's about art.
Which is,
that's the thing. Like, people would always say that love was a creative thing. And I kind of see that now. You know, that search for truth, if someone's being honest with themselves, is love in action in many ways.
That is true. I would agree with that. I would definitely agree
with that. I mean, the objectified result of love between two people capable of making another human is another human.
That's how that works. It's interesting to kind of see the parallels here between, I mean, thinking about religion, God, and a very abstract feeling, and then creating a piece of work.
Like all the religious art that's out there from back in the day is something. But also religion itself was a creation, maybe by more analytical minds to a degree, but it's still a creation.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to limit it to, like, all right, we created it, it's never going to change. Well, that's that process of the square and the circle
for sure.
It's like, wait a minute, we've developed something, but if you solidify it right now, it's going to lose its life. Let's not go tyranny. Let's go into the chaos a bit here and see how we can grow this thing, because to grow it, it's like a lobster shell or a shellfish that's going to have to break to grow. They're going to have to shed that thing to, you know.
For sure.
Yeah, you should see my office with all its sticky notes. And then I just, this last week, put up a huge, like, marker board, and I'll just sit there at night and, like, start scrolling these.
Are they illustrations, or are you doing?
The sticky notes are stickmen illustrations that iterate questions, analogies, and concepts that I have, so I can quick reference them visually. But then the large other thing is like, I just sit there and so if you imagine this is great that this is going to be public, this is hilarious. But if you imagine Satan worshipers.
Oh, wow.
What do Satan worshipers ask Satan for? The stereotypical thing is, like, give me power and lots of sex and money and control. And so imagine, let's pretend Dave Chappelle is telling this story and it's hilarious, right? And he's like, I stumbled across a Satan worship thing, and, you know, And like, it, you know, they go through three or four guys and girls are talking about the money and power and sex mm-hmm. and whatever they want. Mm-hmm. And then it gets to someone who's like, I'd like peace, understanding, and a more kind heart. And, you know, they're like, well, shouldn't you just go to,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's like, well, why? To me, that takes down the literal idea of an embodied thing, like a devil and a god,
mm-hmm.
to these are personifications of, you know, because what are people saying when they want, like, I want immediate sex and immediate money, and they're saying, I don't want to do the work.
Yeah.
I don't want to take the path to actually get to the point there. I just mm-hmm. want to go to the point.
Immediate gratification, yeah.
Yeah, and it's like, these are personifications of, give me what I want without making me work for
sure.
it. It's the lottery,
sure.
essentially.
Yep, yep.
You know, and by going through those processes, you get understanding that brings you peace.
For sure, yep.
And I think it would be a hilarious bit to see, like, a movie where, you know, the one guy's like, I just want yeah. peace and understanding. get thee behind me, Jesus.
For sure.
So
I was curious if you're kind of cataloging this, or if you're taking, you know, you're kind of,
I've been working on trying to put together a documentary for like 5 years now.
Very cool.
But I knew that Ken Burns has a quote, like, it's the artist's responsibility to lead the viewer into hell, and it's mm-hmm. also the artist's responsibility to lead them out.
Yep.
And I didn't want to just put something together that just tore apart religion without
yeah.
understanding
oh, for sure,
it
for
or
sure.
not offering something. And I feel like 2 weeks ago, I mean, I literally sat in my office, like, almost kind of just shaking and doing this and having a realization of what this reality is through creativity.
Mm,
mm. And I don't know how to make that sound less weird, but I mean, it, like, I realized something, and
yeah.
it genuinely has changed my life
sure.
in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like I kept coming up against not understanding something, mm-hmm. and understanding emotions and the creative process. To me, it's like the doors open.
Yeah.
And it's like everything I look at now, I can, it's like I don't know everything,
yep.
but I can understand everything.
Gotcha.
It's
gotcha.
So weird.
Very interesting.
To go through that and to see it, like the ability to be in the presence of my kids
mm.
and just be in that moment and to kind of feel what they're going through.
Sure, sure.
And to know what it is
yep.
and then to be able to put yourself in that place with that understanding. It's like, oh, they're just magically experiencing the world right now.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Shut your critical observer up and just go
and just
go
experience.
Dwell in some emotions with
yeah,
them right now.
Yeah.
You know? And
that's got to allow for that connection on the native
yeah,
tongue
level. It's like,
that's got
to,
you know,
speak some native tongue
yeah,
for a while
yeah,
with
yeah.
your kids.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing, but it's so weird to be able to
yeah.
understand without literally knowing.
Sure, sure.
That is a weird thing.
That is a very weird thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's got to be extremely helpful. I mean, to me, that's kind of the goal, is to be fully in that moment with the little ones, at least, is what I'm thinking about, is
yeah.
to be fully in that moment and to be able to kind of, I think that's one of the things, at least for me, that the kids have helped me out with so much, is to be able to kind of strip away all of the extra thinking and, you know, stress that goes along with, you know, running your own business and the life and the whole nine, and just to be able to, you know,
play with dolls,
smack a balloon all over
smack
the room,
it, yeah,
you know?
Right.
You know, like, it's just like the balloon, you know. It's like, to be able to kind of just completely immerse yourself in that moment and those feelings.
I've found that if I intentionally reflect the expression of my children when they're in those very childish
mm,
moments,
mm-hmm.
that gets them off so much. Like, really? They're just like, this is fun. Like, and I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that is the best. Yeah.
And then I find if I just lay with them for a while and don't say anything, like when they're going to bed, they'll just start talking.
Really? Really?
Yeah. And it's such an amazing thing because, like, my youngest son's not super, he's not a super talkative kid like my oldest son is. But if I just hang out with him like I'm a kid and just, you know, I'll just like nudge him over in his bed and I'll just lay with him for like, you know, 5-10 minutes.
Yeah.
He just starts talking about his day.
Really?
Because, like, you know,
that's amazing.
You know, when a kid comes in and you're like, so how was your day? What would you do? And they're like,
kind of like,
it's all right.
Yeah.
Can I go?
Yeah, yeah.
But if you just like, if you can just be present for a little longer than your articulated observer would allow you to, you get into this just kind of emotional kind of boat ride with them. Then
very
they
cool.
just start to blabber.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow. Oh, you're sharing your feelings and stuff.
Yeah, you know? That's huge. That's huge, you know, because I think, you know, like you said, I mean, our go-to is, hey, good to see you. How's your day? Tell me about everything you learned.
Let's summarize everything right now and I'll get back to what I need to do
20 minutes
for the
and then I can get back to work real quick and answer these emails. Yeah, that's, you know, that is kind of the go-to, but that's not how they communicate.
No.
And that's not how they're going to communicate.
No.
So yeah, taking those moments to just kind of be there with them and stripping away or...
Kick me in the nuts the other night. I was putting my son to bed and his birthday was the next day. And I was like, give him a hug. And I was like, this is the last time I'm going to hug an 8-year-old. I was like,
Oh, those will get you. It happens.
Yeah.
It happens. Oh my gosh. Yeah. That's for sure. I was already becoming a softie before having the kids, and then I'm mush now, you know. I'm just like,
there's one kids book out there where like the mom's like always, no matter what, coming in and taking care of the kid, and like towards the end of the book he goes into adulthood and it reversed to where the kid comes back and is holding the mug.
Yeah.
I'm just like, get that thing out.
Yep. Okay, the end.
Daddy's gotta go now.
That is very, very real. I mean, it just it's a cliche. It completely changes everything about, but no, it really just completely changes your outlook, you know? And I wonder do you think that you would have been able to get to those conclusions in your thinking without having that connection with your kids? Or
I know that where I was in religious belief created a huge amount of cognitive dissonance, just conflict, that was extremely frustrating mentally, that I couldn't understand, that was everything was blocking up. And In putting that aside and putting my own shortcomings aside to really try and get things in line, I still had a lot of emotion that I was attempting to not let come out, that was simply an expression of my own will of what I knew needed to be done at that moment.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
So I would be very unsympathetic, unempathetic.
Okay.
It's like, I'm sorry you fell down and skinned your knee, but life's hard. You're going to have to learn to deal with it.
You know? Okay. Yeah.
And I would just like push that vibe, feeling, whatever out there.
Sure.
And I could just see it land on my kids and on my wife. And it was like a frustration and a lack of understanding within myself that I was channeling. It was just, all right, well, I'm just going to will myself through all of this.
Okay.
And they were just kind of like getting hit by steamroller daddy constantly, you know?
Yeah.
And it wasn't until like that realization of like, you've got to come back to allowing for feelings and you've got to find a way to understand your own feelings. You also have to have a good idea of what proper behavior is. But coming back to understanding those feelings and then understanding why childhood felt so magical. Even if it's a bad childhood, good childhood, there's something far more innocent happening there.
For sure. Yep.
That realization, we went for a big hike, and I was putting my son to bed, and this was like 3 weeks ago before I kind of had this epiphany, and just joking around with him, I was like, "Man, is your childhood everything you dreamed it would be, buddy?" And he, you know, he's kind of like, "Man, you're weird, Dad."
He's like, "How do I answer that?"
But yeah. Immediately that hit me like, oh, you didn't have a chance to dream about this. You don't have a conscious, preconceived expectation of what should be going on here. You're only experiencing it. And it's like realizing that they don't have that, that they're they're under your care and they're simply emotionally growing as well as their articulate knowledge is growing. And you have such a responsibility to validate their feelings at that time and to connect with them, yet guide them in a way that's responsible. And it wasn't until I was able to open myself up to feelings that I was able to really connect with them on that that deeper deeper level. And it's amazing to see the receptiveness and affection towards me that changes in that. I interviewed someone for our documentary a long time ago, and he said he said it better than I'm going to repeat it, but it was something like you can really see your own shortcomings and failures in the faces of those that love you, you know, like the real, it's like
very, very
shit
true
that you put them through.
And
when you really open yourself up to receiving that and seeing it and say, all right, I want to change to be the best I can be, you know, that moment, you know, that's such a turning point of growth and just like, it was funny. We were driving home last night from visiting my in-laws or the other night. And, cause I, my son, when he was like, my oldest son was like five, he drew a picture that, it was a drawing of, him and myself and my wife, and he was crying, and I looked angry, and my wife looked emotional, you know, and he wrote in the bottom, "Don't do this when I'm around." Like that was his work of art, you know? And I was just like, damn.
Wow.
And that like, whoa, you know? And, I was creating that tension in our family from my frustration, from my selfishness, from my lack of understanding. I hadn't processed it, you know? And in seeing that in the face of the people you love, if you're open to it, you know, it's such an effective road of change.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
And driving back the other night, my youngest son was just saying like, "You and mommy are so fun to be around."
Yeah. Oh,
about
that's
the
awesome.
Last like few years.
That's awesome.
So I was like, all right.
That's great.
We're doing this.
Yeah.
We're doing better.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
which, oh my gosh. Wow.
So as you can tell, after 5 o'clock, they allow bands to start practicing.
Oh, yeah. All right. I was just going to start dancing. You know, I figured that was
the drum intro to the outro.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's really timely for me to have this conversation with you being an artist, because I think art, creativity, it's just such an invaluable part of our society reality.
Thank you. I agree. Yeah.
And like the exact same thing is so valuable in keeping a high standard for what we accept as art into our, you know, articulated knowledge.
Sure.
So that the conservative and the liberal, the conscientious, the open, they all play such a part.
For
It's,
for sure.
Hopefully we can get this message out there and everyone will start to appreciate each other more. But
I hope so. I hope so. That would be nice.
Well, I think we're getting the drum outro. That's
sure.
Gonna,
yeah.
The guitar's going to kick in soon.
Oh, really? Sure. Nice. All right. All right. Yeah. Whole jam session going
Sometimes
on.
Sometimes if you're here after seven, you might get high.
So oh, all right. All right.
So it can get
I got a little ride back. I think I'm going to try to get
even though there's big signs saying that, you know, but yeah, the bands and the creation.
No, for sure. For sure.
But anyways, well, hey, thank you so much for taking the time and coming down tonight. And,
thank you. Thank you for having me.
That was super, appreciate that. Super good conversation. I know that's phonetically or whatever, not the right thing to say, but sorry for talking constantly, but I've had so much happen in my life just mentally recently that it's hard not to talk. So.
No, absolutely. And I appreciate it. I mean, like I said, you unearthed a few things that, you know, I hadn't thought about and kind of changed the way I thought about kind of things that I'm doing daily. So
hopefully this conversation has acted like a creative thing that we can take back to our solidified ideas of ourselves that we can then break apart and grow.
Absolutely. So, yeah.
There we go.
Yeah, man. For sure. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Ryan Adams, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Down to Biddeford. And check out Ryan Adams' design theory article coming up in the upcoming issue of Main Home Design.
Yeah, so, for sure.
Ryan Adams, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.